Thanks, Jonga. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Thursday, June 4th, 2015. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Chris Gande.
And I'm Jonga Kandemiri.
Here are our top stories this evening.
Zimbabwe has been ranked 100 out of 102 countries in the 2015 World Justice Project Rule of Law Index.
It is a heartbreaking ranking in the sense that it appears the authorities in Zimbabwe are not bothered or are not paying attention to these important indicators that all is not well within Zimbabwe.
Manicaland Provincial Affairs Minister Mandichi Mene says vendors won't be removed from Mutare streets despite a week-long ultimatum issued by local government minister Ignatius Chombo ordering them to leave within 7 days.
Whoever is involved in this sacking of people out of the streets, it seems to us that they failed somewhere, somehow, and they want to finish it up with the vendors. Vendors haven't affected anything. They are trying to make a living.
And Zimbabwe starts buying its discarded local currency from members of the public for up to 40 cents for certain denominations.
Zimbabwe has been ranked 100 out of 102 countries in the 2015 World Justice Project Rule of Law Index. Zimbabwe ranked a few notches above war-torn Afghanistan and socialist nation Venezuela, while Denmark, Norway, and Sweden were the top three nations said to be adhering to the tenets of the rule of law. The World Justice Project, which releases the annual index, bases its rankings on experiences and perceptions of the general public and in-country experts worldwide about prevailing situations in various nations. The organization says effective rule of law reduces corruption, combats poverty and disease, and protects people from injustices. Reporter Tatenda Gumbo speaks to human rights lawyer Dewama Vinga, who says Zimbabwe's law ranking is surprising.
It is a heartbreaking ranking in the sense that it appears the authorities in Zimbabwe are not bothered or are not paying attention to these important indicators that all is not well within Zimbabwe. You cannot have a nation, any nation developing without the rule of law, without, you know, proper governance mechanisms. This is the bedrock in terms of investor confidence, in terms of calling in and having foreign direct investment. So when you hear that Zimbabwe is in the doldrums economically and cannot attract investors, it is precisely to do with indices like this one, where Zimbabwe is at the bottom of the pile.
The WJP says here that effective rule of law reduces corruption, combats poverty and disease, and also protects people from injustices. How would you yourself, of course, rank Zimbabwe looking at these factors?
Well, I think there is a lot of credibility in these findings. If you look at the reality on the ground, if you look at how rampant corruption is inside Zimbabwe, all institutions virtually, the police, almost every roadblock, there is corruption. Within ZANU-PF itself as the ruling party, there has talked for a long time of a lot of corruption. Big parastatals have been embroiled in corruption. You talk of Air Zimbabwe, which has collapsed because of corruption. You talk of the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation. You talk of the electricity supply, ZESI, among others. But the thing that's interesting, Tatenda, is that there has been no accountability.
And that was human rights lawyer Dewama Vinga speaking with Studio 7 from Britain. Reacting to Zimbabwe's ranking by the World Justice Project's former ZANU-PF legislator, Bright Matonga says the ranking index is another move to smear Zimbabwe's image.
The government and people of Zimbabwe do not support corruption, do not support the break of the rule of law. Anyone caught on the wrong side of the law, they are arrested. We may not agree on the mechanism, we may not agree on the effectiveness of the system, but we have commissions in place, Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission and the Corruption Commission. They are in place, they need funding, they will be funded, they need to be supported. But for any an outsider to say that Zimbabwe is right at the top, I think it's very mischievous, it's very misguided, and it won't achieve the results that you want to achieve. Remember, Zimbabwe has been under attack for nearly 15 years because of illegal activities, because of the bullying tactics of the Americans in the United Kingdom, because of the issue of land. But Zimbabwe has moved on. The economy is stable, and we're rebuilding the country. There are challenges, but if American government or British government go around intimidating investors, it doesn't help anyone.
But Dr. Matonga, there are some that would say that even with the mechanisms in place, even with the law, the issue of rule of law is outstanding, and Zimbabweans do not have adequate rule of law in the country.
Which country has adequate rule of law? I would want to know. I would want to live in that place. The people that are dying in the Mediterranean Sea, those foreigners, they're dying. Africans, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Iraqis, who cares? We should ask ourselves, why are they being blocked from going there?
That was former ZANU-PF legislator Bright Matonga speaking with Studio 7 from Harare.
Manicaland Provincial Affairs Minister Mandita Wepichimene says vendors won't be removed from Mutare streets despite a week-long ultimatum issued by local government minister Ignatius Chombo ordering them to leave within 7 days. Our correspondent, Lloyd Amoyo, has more details.
Chimene says only when the vendors are allocated the places of operation, then they would be taken off the streets. According to records from the Civic Center, Mutare City has at least 2,000 vendors, most of whom were former employees of closed or downscaling companies, among them Mutare Board and Paper Mills, Karina, Keynes Foods, Quest Motoring. Ms. Chimene says she will not chase off the vendors, at least for now. A Mutare vendor who identified himself as Clyde Mumbure says there is no way they will get off the streets until the government offers them jobs.
Yeah, the thing is, like, as I see it, the government, whoever is involved in this seeking of people out of the streets, it seems to us that they failed somewhere, somehow, and they want to finish it up with the vendors. Vendors haven't affected anything. They are trying to make a living just because there are no industries so that they can put food on the table, send their children to school. But then it seems as if these people want to just get harsh with the people. If they can open industries as soon as possible, as they want to take us from the streets as soon as possible, it will be fine.
Another vendor, Cleopas Mawandike, says they are struggling, not out of their own making, and they need relief from President Robert Mugabe's impunity.
It's not easy, my friend. It's not easy, because we are struggling. Our life is not is so far, it's not good, our life. We are struggling. As you see, if we move from here to another place where they are staying, to the bar, no customers, because it's a bar, yes.
Edward Mundirwira of Shikanga in Mutare, who sells second-hand shoes, says the ruling ZANU-PF government should simply create the promised 2 million jobs in the past 2013 election manifesto of the party.
You know, my friend, our government is the cause of all these problems. He's the one who caused the problem to all these people to have here in the street later. I used to remember, during their campaigning in 2013 for election manifesto, they promised the people that we are going to create 2 million jobs, isn't it? Right? After the election, they failed to produce those jobs. And then they create 2 million vendors in the streets. They didn't come back to us.
But Ernest Chauke of Fabrish Park in the city says the move is noble only when they are allocated decent areas to operate from.
It's okay, but the councils should give us places for marketing.
As the country dithers on the throes of despondency amongst the citizenry, many are unhappy with the move to render the disempowered populace of their only means of survival, since the government tends to ignore their plight. Reporting for Studio 7 in Mutare, this is Lloyd Amoyo.
Zimbabweans who have been holding on to their now defunct local currency will soon be requested to surrender it in exchange for United States dollars in what the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe describes as part of a demonetization exercise to bring finality to the Zimbabwe dollar. But people are not happy with the rate of exchange, as the central bank will fork out about 2 cents for some of the banknotes and up to $2 for others. Some notes that were issued after 2008, ranging from $10,000 to $50 billion, are not part of the exercise. The country dumped its currency in 2009 following historic hyperinflation. Economist Prosper Chitambara tells Studio 7 the move to buy the disused currency is likely to improve investor confidence following incessant rumors that the government is trying to reintroduce the local currency.
Well, I think it's a positive development. What it then does is that it brings confidence, some measure of confidence within the financial system, and also it helps to assure the transacting public that probably the multi-currency regime is here to stay. So probably within the foreseeable, in the mid-term or in the short to mid-term, government is actually confirming that they are not going to change the currency. There's not going to be any change of the currency.
Some people are not happy with the exchange rate at which the old Zimbabwe dollar will be transacted with the US dollar. Well, how do you think they came up with this rate?
I'm not really sure, because there were so many exchange rates that were prevailing during that time. Some were using, I think the official one was the UN rate. Probably that's the one that they are going to use. But then they need to come up with a cutoff date, or with a benchmark date rather, on which they can take the whatever exchange rate they're going to use. But my hunch is that probably they'll use the UN rate, which was closer to reality than the official rate. So that's a concern. And also the other concern probably is to do with the amount that has been budgeted for this war exercise. It's about 20 million US, which may not be adequate.
That was Prosper Chitambara, an independent economist, speaking with Studio 7 from Harare.
A Zimbabwean living in Istanbul, Turkey, Toliwe Ntebele Dube, who has written a book with 52 poems titled Deep, Deep Blue, says she does her work even when she is using public transport or watching people conducting their day-to-day activities. She speaks to Studio 7's Gibbs Dube about her poems and other issues.
Basically, I'm a teacher by profession. I write in my pastime. I enjoy writing, and I've been compiling poems for quite some time now, and I just thought, let me put them together and see what happens.
So you have actually just written a book with a lot of poems. Tell us a bit about it.
The poems are basically from my past and my experiences, because I'm an international schools teacher. I've taught in quite a number of countries. I lived in Zimbabwe for the first 32 years of my life. So the poems are based on my interactions with people, on what I think of things, especially life, death, just everyday subjects, really.
So now I've been just going through your poems, and there's one that actually touched me, you know, something to do with footprints, you know, along the edge of reason. That's all very right. Catchy, right?
Yeah, I enjoyed writing that one, yes.
What is this all about?
This is about two people who are actually in love, but because of their personalities, they don't actually speak about the love between them, but it is so real, it is almost tangible. And they try and hide it behind mundane things like everyday conversations. And yet the bond just twitches between both of them. And they are very, very much compatible.
And then Deep, Deep Blue. Can you recite it?
My love for you is a deep, deep blue. Not the proverbial blood red, red. That is too common to be true. Mine is off the beaten track, seeking and delighting in the new. praising and transcending the ordinary and normal into angelic and heroic. Never once forgetting to anchor to ground, fancy to reality, turn sultry glow to hush bright, cool hot passion with ice bright.
So, okay, Deep Deep Blue, what is it all about? Can you recite it?
Deep Deep Blue is about a love that is not common, a love that accepts weaknesses and the strengths of whoever the person is in love with. Let me recite it for you then. My love for you is a deep, deep blue, not the proverbial blood red, red. That is too common to be true. Mine is off the beaten track, seeking and delighting in the new, praising and transcending the ordinary and normal into angelic and heroic. Never once forgetting to anchor, to ground, fancy to reality, turn sultry glow to hush bright, cool hot passion with ice from northern reason, accept the dismal with the blissful. That's my deep, deep blue, dished freely for you, with all feeling and sense, not the proverbial blood red, red.
That was Toliwe Ntebele Dube, a Zimbabwean living in Istanbul, Turkey, speaking with Studio 7's Gibbs Dube from Istanbul.
You are listening to Studio 7 for Zimbabwe from the Voice of America in Washington.
Studio 7 can be found on the 4930, 5930 and 15455 kHz shortwave frequencies. We also broadcast on 909 medium wave or AM frequency.
Coming up,
a congressional hearing on Zimbabwe in the United States tables relations between the two nations.
And the European Union unveils a $13 million package for Zimbabwe's health sector.
But first, a look at regional and international news.
The United Nations appealed to the international community for $500 million on Thursday to maintain its operations in conflict-stricken Iraq, where a top official says humanitarian aid will be scaled back dramatically without further funding.
An explosion at a gas station in Ghana's capital has killed some 90 people who had gathered for shelter during torrential rains.
And former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner says he has proof of financial dealings involving the organization's governing body and the 2010 general election in his home country, Trinidad and Tobago.
The U.S. Congress has raised concern and skepticism over future relations with Zimbabwe. This was revealed through a line of questioning from members of the U.S. Congress at a hearing in Washington Thursday. Studio 7 reporter Ndimiyake Ngwakalele has more.
In their quest to find out what is really happening in Zimbabwe, members of Congress had a barrage of questions for witnesses. Shannon Smith of the State Department, former Zimbabwean white commercial farmer Ben Frith, and Imani Countess of the Solidarity Center.
If you could just, for the record again, outline those sanctions, what's in place, how targeted are they, and did you hear appeals to change those sanctions when you were there?
Would you agree with Dr. Smith that the opposition is so fractured that they're ineffective?
Congressman Christopher Smith, the chair of the subcommittee on Africa that sponsored the hearing titled The Future of U.S.-Zimbabwe Relations, raised concern over continued reports of human rights violations by the government and President Robert Mugabe's ability to lead the country.
If the government's repressive tactics are not troubling enough, political jockeying in Zimbabwe, including the dismissal of Vice President Joyce Mujuru, places the succession to President Mugabe in doubt, which puts U.S. policy in question.
Responding to the questions on sanctions, Shannon Smith of the State Department reiterated the position that sanctions were targeted.
We have sanctions on approximately 106 individuals and 70 entities, And they are intended to be targeted. They are aimed at individuals who have disrupted democracy, engaged in corruption and other acts. The Department of Treasury, the OFAC office, evaluates those situations. But more fundamentally, it remains the sort of strongest statement, I think, of American values. Does the Zimbabwe government continue to blame their woes on it? Absolutely.
The members of Congress pressed witnesses on the state of the opposition, which the U.S. had once supported and counted on as the alternative government to that of President Mugabe.
It's a matter of sort of fact and record now that the opposition has been splintering, that the Movement for Democratic Change now has multiple movements for democratic change within it under separate leadership. There is no sort of unifying message at the moment that stretches across these parties.
Congresswoman Karen Bass, a ranking member of the subcommittee, too pressed on the question of the opposition, querying reports that they had become ineffective. Countess of the Solidarity Center responded in the affirmative.
At this point, I don't see a viable alternative today, but there are discussions going on. Morgan Tsvangirai, for example, has been engaging in grassroots conversations. I know that the MDC renewal has also been split even further. There are individuals that are forming new parties. There's rumors that within ZANU, individuals who've been forced out will form a new political party. There's a lot of conversation. But at this point in time, what is very, very clear that is that no one in power seems to be working on behalf of the people of Zimbabwe, and certainly not the working people.
With the opposition weakened and alternatives to the current government lacking, Congressman Smith questioned the role of China, Russia, in helping Zimbabwe circumvent its isolation from the West. Congresswoman Bass also raised allegations of a military base being built by China, an allegation Studio 7 could not verify. In light of those reports and the deteriorating situation in Zimbabwe, Congressman Kurt Clawson questioned the reason for supporting Zimbabwe in areas outside humanitarian issues, saying that other efforts were, in his words, hopeless. Countess, whose organization champions the right of workers, stressed the importance of staying engaged in Zimbabwe for the security of neighboring countries.
Zimbabwe is in the middle of southern Africa. What do you think will happen in South Africa, Botswana, Mozambique, Namibia, if that country implodes?
Responding to this, Clawson rebuked regional leaders who he says have continued to prop up President Mugabe despite the wave of refugees fleeing their countries due to the hardships in Zimbabwe.
So realistically, what do we do? I mean, I'm all for humanitarian help, but these same countries that you said will be impacted by the implosion are sitting it out while white people, black people, women, men, poor, everybody gets hurt by this guy.
Ben Frith, a former farmer in Zimbabwe whose father-in-law died as a result of the land raids, called on the members of Congress to maintain pressure on President Mugabe to adhere to the rule of law, particularly for the country's remaining white population who he says have been segregated and victimized.
What I was asking the United States to do today in the spirit of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement is to say that racism is wrong.
Journalism professor Stanford Mukasa lauded the congressional members for holding the hearing on Zimbabwe.
The United States has made it clear that it will not engage Zimbabwe in a positive way in as far as supporting its political process until and unless democracy, rule of law are all respected. And Itai Dzamara has now become a kind of an icon in terms of what must be done in Zimbabwe today.
The congressional hearing ended without any indications of dramatic change in relations between the two nations in the near future, with the U.S. expected to maintain its position of targeted sanctions on President Mugabe and his inner circle. Reporting for Studio 7 from Washington, this is Dimyake Mwakalielie.
Meanwhile, a delegation of member companies from the Corporate Council on Africa, or CCA, a non-profit organization which promotes business and investment between the United States and African nations, has arrived in Zimbabwe. In a statement, the U.S. Embassy said the delegation is on a two-day visit as part of a regional trade mission to Zambia and Zimbabwe. The embassy said CCA member companies will use their time in the two countries to assess the business climate and comparative advantages.
The European Union, or EU, has unveiled a $13 million aid package to the revitalization of Zimbabwe's health sector. Speaking at the official signing ceremony in Harare yesterday, UNICEF country representative Reza Husseini said the grant will be effectively used for tackling various problems bedeviling the health sector.
Today, we are signing the 12 million euro contribution for a strengthening of health services and to improve the maternal and neonatal child health here in Zimbabwe. The grant is part of the EU's commitment to health transition funds, which comes to an end at the end of this year. It brings the total contribution to 52 million, exactly a third of the total contribution that has come from all the donors to health transition funds since it started in March 2011.
Speaking at the same occasion, EU representative Philip Van Dam said the European bloc of nations has been helping Zimbabwe in this and other sectors.
I think we have achieved results in this country. Maternal and children under 5 mortality rates have started to decrease in Zimbabwe over recent years, and these for the first time in 20 years. There is a very significant achievement with a double meaning. It means in the first place that Zimbabwe has managed to avert several thousands of maternal deaths over recent years.
In his remarks, Health Minister David Parerenyatwa said the funding is welcome in a nation where most of its ruling party leaders have been dropped from EU sanctions.
I recall the support that we received from the EU under the Lome Convention in the 1980s. Those of you who were in the system in the 1980s, there was a Lome Convention, EU assisted. And now we are assisting again. So in spite of what's being said about EU and Zimbabwe, the EU to a large extent has continued to pour money into the health sector, albeit through sometimes through the non-government sector. And I'm glad now it's coming back into the system. There was a time when the EU said, we'll give money,
That was Health Minister David Parerenyatwa.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On the night of September 11th, 2012, members of the Ansar al-Sharia terrorist group attacked two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya. Using machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, the militants targeted the U.S. Special Mission compound in a nearby annex in repeated assaults, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, wounding two more U.S. personnel, and three Libyan contract guards. Both facilities were destroyed. Rewards were offered, and an intensive search mounted for those responsible for the attack. On June 15th, U.S. military personnel arrested a key suspect in the operation, Ahmed Abu Katala. A senior leader of Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi has been charged with murder and other charges and will be sent to the United States to stand trial. Others involved in the attack remain at large, and the United States will do whatever it takes to see that justice is done. Created after the fall of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, Ansar al-Sharia has been involved in many attacks in the region, targeting civilians, and assassinating or attempting to assassinate security officials and political actors in eastern Libya. Its members continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in Libya and have been designated as international terrorist organizations. Toward this end, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of any individual responsible for the Benghazi attacks. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy or the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States, bringing our show to an end. My name is Chris Gande. Good night.
And I'm Jonga Kandemire.